The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Sheldon Bonovitz. I'm a member of the Board of Directors of the Free Library of Philadelphia Foundation and a proud supporter of this great library. This evening's authors event is made possible by the Free Library Foundation. Through the support of private philanthropy, the foundation enriches the library's essential services and quality programs. Please consider making a gift of support to the foundation. Information about making a gift can be found in your program this evening, or donate online at freelibrary.org/support. Your gift will help continue to make it possible for the library to advance literacy and enrich the cultural fabric of our region. Thank you. Tonight it is my pleasure to introduce Simon Chama, noted historian and a genius of storytelling, according to the Times of London. Author of several books, including The Embarrassment of Riches, Citizens, A Chronicle of the French Revolution, and National Book Critics Circle Award winner, Rough Crossings, Simon Chama is a professor of art history and history at Columbia University. He is also a cultural essayist for The New Yorker and has written and presented more than 30 critically acclaimed documentaries for the BBC and PBS, including A History of Britain, The Power of Art, and The American Future. Of Chama's newest book, Scribble, 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 Publisher Weekly raves, in these lively essays and reportage, Chama turns his omnivorous erudition and warm prose to a vast array of topics. He approaches every subject with gusto and amusement and always has smart things to say. It's truly a pleasure to have him here tonight with us. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Simon Chama.
I didn't drink any of your water.
You're all thinking, what the hell is he doing texting? You know, isn't he even going to look at us and say something? Did the kind of Sheldon tell you to turn your cell phones off? My favorite play in the world was Spamalot, because somebody comes to the front of the theater and says, ladies and gentlemen, I would like you to turn all your cell phones on because the show is complete crap. You know, it's just... The reason I'm looking at this, everyone, is it has on it, right now, the best thing ever written about spring. And you, class, are going to tell me who wrote it, or else. And it's not me, but it's someone who is my kind of god of essay writing. Before the swallow, before the daffodil, and not much later than a snowdrop, the common toad salutes the coming of spring after his own fashion, which is to emerge from a hole in the ground where he has lain, buried since the previous autumn, and crawl as rapidly as possible towards the nearest suitable patch of water. Something, some kind of shudder in the earth, or perhaps merely a rise of a few degrees in the temperature, has told him it's time to wake up, although a few toads appear to sleep the clock round and miss out a year from time to time. At any rate, I've more than once dug them up, alive and apparently well, in the middle of summer. At this period, after his long fast, the toad has a very spiritual look, like a strict Anglo-Catholic towards the end of Lent. His movements are languid and purposeful, his body is shrunken, and by contrast, his eyes are abnormally large. This allows one to notice what one might not at another time, that a toad has about the most beautiful eye of any living creature. It is like gold, or more exactly, it's like the golden-colored semi-precious stone which one sometimes sees in signet rings, and which, I think, is called a chrysoberyl. Who wrote that? Who? No. Any more bids? It's a Brit, I have to say. No, it is a bit Nashy, isn't it? That's in its the conic cleverness at flipping. It's, believe it or not, George Orwell. You're absolutely right to go. Oh, absolutely right. Good class on the ball, because it is. it is so lyrical. It's so startlingly lyrical for Orwell, whom one thinks of as a kind of, you know, prince of sort of fierce asperity, of someone who really seldom moved out from a kind of polemical position taking. But that would be really to misdescribe Orwell, wouldn't it? Those of you who may have read, I mean, when we were kids, we got Animal Farm, great book. We got 1984, ditto. But it was precisely because 1984 was seen to be a weapon in the Cold War, especially when it was assigned in core curricula, as I think it no longer is, in the United States during the Cold War. It's precisely because it was an attack on totalitarianism by not a repentant, but a confirmed socialist. And Orwell never stopped being a socialist, but he was, a social democrat. Although, you know, in current atmosphere in the United States today, that'd be equivalent to being Trotsky or something, you know. But because of that, Orwell's novels were very often thought to be, in particular, fictionalizations essentially of political positions, which, you know, they weren't not that, it's true. But 1984 has extraordinary moments of memory rapture of an extremely poignant kind. Particularly, you remember this little woman hanging out her washing, whistling a tune that Winston Smith barely remembers. But amazing moments, really, about the loss of memory. The totalitarianism consists, and therefore made an extreme deep bite on the young Sharma, who must have read 1984 when I was 12 years old, because totalitarianism exists to erase history. In two respects, to erase the inconvenience of memory and also to erase the preternatural contentiousness of history. History is an argument, if it is anything at all, an argument without end, the great Dutch historian Peter Heil once said. And those two things, of course, would be unacceptable in the Orwellian managed state. Now, Orwell was a problem for me until I read The Toad and other things like it in this kind of vein of Orwell with his, you know, his shirt collar undone and much else, really. Because he was held up to us in the 1950s, not just as a polemicist, which he was, but as someone for whom English writing, as he himself said, should be as transparent as a cleanly scrub window pane. It should be it should privilege the limpid, the clear, the unfussy, the unadjectival. And it's very hard to make, it was hard to make the young Sharma, it's hard to make the old Sharma unadjectival. alas. And so Orwell was really a very hard template, actually, for us to be commanded to follow as our model of pure English style, our kind of genius, Strunk and White or something. And it was particularly difficult for me because I had a Dickensian childhood in every conceivable way, which would be too complicated and too lengthy to tell you about, but I would save this, that my father was so enamored of Dickens that he would read it out loud in what's now, I suppose, an unimaginable thing, or maybe some of you did that to your, I hope, for your children. My father would read us a lot of, my sister and I, a lot of Dickens, a lot of which was extremely frightening, scared the hell out of me. And with Dickens' philosophy of the plenitude of life, of the importance somehow of containing within impossibly broken, massively python-like in the appetite of the sentence to engorge itself with yet more matter and content and picture and words. Dickens did all of that, and my father, who was a superabundant figure in many ways himself, rejoiced in that. But it made me believe that English had this extraordinary kind of, and I don't want to, as it were, mix my snake metaphors here, but this sort of serpentine arabesque quality. It's often been commented, actually, that English art, there was a little essay-length book now derided as utterly intellectually and morally bankrupt, neither, which I think is quite true, by Nicholas Pevsner, who was the great doyen of architectural description in the 1950s and early 60s, called The Englishness of English Art. It is berated for being sort of, you know, little Englander about that. But there was one point at least that Pevsner made, and that was, and he got it from looking at grotesques on English cathedral architecture, and in carvings, and green men particularly, you know, those men who sometimes are on the bosses of supporting piers and columns who have vegetation coming out of their puffed cheeks. And from that, Pevsner quite rightly, I think, thought of when what might be called sort of some strain of vernacular English art representation emerged, which can't possibly be earlier than Hogarth, I think, because most English art before that had been imported either as instructed from the Italian Renaissance or a very severe wannabe kind of classicism of the kind represented by Hogarth's father-in-law, James Thornhill, who he wanted to emulate as a history painter. But it's with Hogarth and Hogarth's extraordinary kind of appetite for caricature, for figuration, for story, above all for story, for narrative. Hogarth is an extraordinary storyteller. He's too wordy, either directly or simply all following the storyline of all those so-called modern morality tales. But Pevsner made the point, which I think was rather wonderfully taken. It may have been made before him, but I don't know where, that the actual formal design of Hogarthian prints in particular, graphic art, and to some extent in some of the paintings, with its, we would now say, pretentiously in intellectual and academic circles, entropic. In other words, a kind of formation that eats itself, you know, collapsing. Things collapse constantly in Hogarth. Men, highborn men, fall off their sedan chair. A drunken mother loses her baby down a cellar, horrifyingly. Things just sort of constantly falling apart. And Pevsner said, well, if you look at the design, it actually disobeys all the instructions of classical art education. It is above all serpentine, the serpentine line, a Baroque line, really. But what it does, which Baroque doesn't, was simply to design itself in these great wheeling, bounding, somersaulting motions inside the work of art to contain a storyline, to contain a kind of twist and turn, a moment of the unexpected. And whether or not Hogarth's closeness to Garrick and the English theatre was partly responsible for that or whatever, one doesn't know. But the kind of irresistibility that really English art has, particularly for content, makes England, and by extension Britain, but it is an English thing above all, I think. I mean, possibly a fortiori is an Irish thing, but it's certainly an English thing that the purest of abstract expressionism, literally the abstraction of formal design out of the earthy nature of storytelling, is extremely almost biologically alien to English painting, I think. Think about aggressively modern painters like Francis Bacon, for example. They're absolutely the same. Hogarthian, serpentine line, forms dissolve, reform themselves. That seems to me not an obtuse point made by Nicholas Pevsner. And so it was. Excuse the digression. What? Sharma digress? Heaven forbid. An unheard of thing. That was the kind of writing I liked. And it did, as I say, have its terrors, because actually my sister and I became so accustomed to these Dickensian readings. We were, when we got of an age, we were given parts to play, as it were. And my father had such a sort of unpredictable and usually fairly unsuccessful business career that my mother, hysterical with terror at the latest commercial and financial fiasco. We'd always know this, actually, that things were gone wrong. We lived in a kosher home, a Jewish home. And if there was a Friday night when my father would come home and rather bizarrely start toying with his chicken noodles, my sister and I, he would do this. He would sort of hold them and he wouldn't whirl them around his head, but almost. It's because it was one of the very few occasions my sister and I saw him drunk because he was too frightened to explain to my mother exactly how serious the problem was. And my sister and I would roll our eyes and go and get our little suitcases and start packing again. But my mother would say, we're all going to the workhouse. Now, for the 9-year-old Simon, this was not a literary allusion or a figure of speech at all. I thought we really were going to the workhouse, actually. And I remember going to my father and saying, "Dad, you know, what's gruel?" And he said, the stinker, he said, "You won't like it, sonny." Rotten thing to do. But we loved him. He was a wonderful man in many ways. Anyway, we did have this sense that that kind of writing, he loved Balzac as well. Balzac, Dickens, the more accessible Joyce, Joyce of the Dubliners and Portrait of the Young Man, artist, he loved Dylan Thomas. He loved this kind of extreme, performative, theatrical, superabundant kind of writing. And what then I had to go to school was to try and be like the extremely unabundant, really, Orwell. And moreover, we were taught by a generation of the so-called new critics who'd learn their criticism at the hands of the work of T.S. Eliot and I.O. Richards, which was, again, an extremely dogmatic and stringent view of what was actually English writing, which was Chaucer, Shakespeare, the metaphysical poets. Then you skipped Milton, please, absolutely out of the question. Milton was this sort of horrifying Latin mutated form. Pope, not even worth thinking about. Pompous, bloviator, total failure to understand Cadence except as a kind of parody of Horace. And then you skip Romantics, complete joke, except Keats's prose. We allowed that. We allowed one Dickens book, Hard Times, the most boring thing he ever wrote, I think, actually. So we were really, really, these were all no-nos. These were no, zones we were not allowed to enter. F.R. Leavis, who I later encountered at Cambridge, who had this kind of extraordinary messianic, wild, fluffy white hair and a sort of fantastically, he basically, I realized at some point, actually, that Leavis's sense of his own dress, which was never varied, it was always a kind of white shirt, open neck, extremely, I have hiked on the Cumbrian Highlands, burnt over complexion. It was basically the sort of D.H. Lawrence guide to dressing, really, actually, as sort of slightly fake proletarian poet savant. And Leavis, who'd spent all his time saying Dickens as kind of worthlessly self-indulgent mockery of a writer, then gave a kind of an extraordinary, now famous lecture of atonement in the Cambridge University Senate House when he got up and said, "Well, I've had a chance to reflect on my severe views about Dickens." And then he went on, he said the same thing about Tolstoy, about whom he'd also actually waxed rather severe. He went on to praise them both, but especially Dickens. And at the end of it all, leaving us all a bit thunderstruck, a woman got up actually and said, "Well, Dr. Leavis, for in your entire life you've been telling us really that we shouldn't go anywhere near Charles Dickens and that, one thing is worse than the other. David Copperfield's tantamount to a literary war crime practically. And what do you have to say for yourself? Now it's all very well you saying, whoops, I have a second thoughts." And Leavis, who was notoriously bad tempered, an incredible kind of hair trigger line of temper, said, "I don't really know what to say to you, my good lady, except I'm as frightfully, frightfully sorry about all this." And I turned to the person next to me and said, "Who is that woman?" And the person said, "Oh, it's Mrs. Leavis." I thought it was it's true. It's a way to get you to repent. So discovering the Orwell of the Toad was a kind of liberation, the relaxed Orwell, the lyrical Orwell, the sensuous Orwell, of which there is a lot, And the other thing I discovered in Orwell, and it made me want to be an essayist and made me feel I wanted to develop different kinds of literary voices if I could. You know, I was a journalist sort of instinctively, really, as well as, I hope, scholarly historian from the time I was a child, really. School magazine, very bad. Founded university newspaper, even worse, but so on. But I always wanted to have that kind of... And I have... I sincerely dedicate this book of essays, most of which is journalism, not all of it, there's some unpublished stuff here, to my editors, because actually I, you know, you write in a different way, or you try to, without really being deliberately chameleon-like, as I've been called that. But you write in a different way for, you know, a Vogue food column than you would for a New Yorker quickly turn around art piece than you would, again, for a Guardian political column, for example. And it's the mastery of different voices, different moments, different audiences. I now, contributing to the Financial Times, and I do all sorts of things, from interviews to, and I like those different, slightly different styles of literary attack. But I guess the essay, Other Than the Toad, of Orwell's, which I particularly, felt, wow, there's something really extraordinary about the great essay, is an essay, again, which those of you who haven't read it really must, called Leo Tolstoy and the Fool. And it is, again, one of the greatest things ever written in any form in English. And it's so extraordinarily cunning. It made me realize that the great essay is actually a kind of non-fiction short story, that it has actually, you would say, a dramaturgy. It follows certain narrative, not rules, but it seeks to... It's not just simply a set of arguments strung together in vivid, robust, clear prose. On the contrary, when you're going for higher stakes, you really do kind of control the pace of reading in a great essay. That's what, one of the very greatest essay writers before Orwell, probably only, actually might arguably be greater even than Orwell, that's William Hazlitt. If you, again, don't know the works of Hazlitt, I can't recommend them too highly. He flourished circa, 1800 to 1820, was a sort of puppy dog who trotted behind the Romantics, who mostly despised him, particularly Coleridge, for his adoration. And Hazlitt did actually everything. He was the first great sports writer. He wrote amazingly on boxing and slightly less amazingly on horse racing, but boxing was his big thing. He was a parliamentary reporter. He wrote about the theater. He wrote brilliantly about art. And he wrote just about manners and mores. An incredible essay my students all love. It's called On the Pleasure of Hating, which has a certain kind of ferocious candor to it. Another wonderful essay is called On Actors in Boxes, which is absolutely wonderful. Hazlitt complaining that it's bad enough that you have to see, people like Fanny Kemble or Edmund Kean overacting in the parts. You then have to tolerate them coming to the theatre and standing in special boxes to take the cheers of the audience in plays in which they were not even taking part themselves. So you realise as you go on from Hazlitt that you're actually reading him on the birth of celebrity culture, and it's really kind of extraordinary piece of sharp, very, very sharp exhilaration, really incredible piece of sharp perception. So Leo Tolstoy in The Fool has what Hazlitt had, which is, as I say, not to be too pretentious, kind of dramaturgy of the non-fiction short story. And it sets out to ask one great question, this particular essay of Orwell's. And the question is, why did Tolstoy despise Shakespeare? Why did he think Shakespeare was the most overrated writer ever? Why was he incapable? He couldn't understand what people saw in Shakespeare, particularly the greater the claims made for Shakespeare plays, for the great tragedies, for Othello and Macbeth and Hamlet and Julius Caesar, and above all for King Lear. He really could only just see a kind of worthlessly histrionic talent expended on nothing in particular. And Tolstoy had intelligence the size of a planet. This was very extraordinary, weird misperception and caricature of Shakespeare. Very odd bee to have in his bonnet. But Tolstoy could have weird bees in his bonnet. This is not Orwell's. I will just say, I'll come on to the story about Tolstoy that occurs to me, because some of you, at least two of you, are going to go and read this essay. I know. I hope so. It's Philadelphia. You must. And it would spoil it to deliver, because the essay really does have a punchline. And what Orwell does is drop clues in as the essay runs along like a great crime story as to why, in fact, Tolstoy might have this view of Shakespeare, and particularly might have it of King Lear. And when the answer is delivered, it's of a kind of brow smacking, of course, which is the same thing when you discover that it was the gardener's nine-year-old who actually cut off the granny with a pair of garden shears or something, and you should have seen that coming all along. It has that "I should have seen it coming all along" moment. It's just absolutely amazing. And then, you know, after the kind of twist hits you, the profundity of actually what's being said sinks in. Tolstoy was indeed pernickety. Isaiah Berlin, who I write about in Scribble Scribble, told me this story. Who knows if it's true? Non è vero e ben trovato. But Tolstoy, as you know, at the end of his life. Any of you seen The Last Station, by the way? I mean, you have. Isn't it? Wonderful film. Wonderful, wonderful film. Christopher Plummer. Very improbable as Tolstoy. Absolutely fantastic. Spot on as Tolstoy. Anyway, Tolstoy is given to delivering powerful moral advice to the young, and makes it known that he would always be available to young people who wanted to put these deep moral questions. And at one point, two students march all the way from some miserable kind of, pig hole, really, somewhere in the Caucasus, and they go all the way to Yasnaya Polyana, and they knock on the door, and the servant answers, and they say, "Well, excuse us, could we see Lev Nikolaevich, because we have a question to put to him?" And he says he will be responsive to anybody who has these. And the servant says, "Just wait here for a minute." He goes back to him. Tolstoy is rocking back and forth, and he's smoking his pipe, and says, "Well, master, you know, these two young men have marched all the way from sort of obscure Hamlet in the Caucasus, and they want to..." And Tolstoy says, "Oh, I'm not in, too tired." And so the servant gets to the door and says, "I'm tremendously sorry about the master." And at that moment, before we can finish the sentence, Tolstoy, his beard flowing like mad white flame, says, "Young men, I am here. I have sinned, but I'm here. Tell me what the question you want to put to me is." And the young men, understandably disconcerted, said, "Well, Lev Nikolaevich, you preach that it is wrong to resist evil with violence, but what if a tiger sprang from the jungle at you?" And Tolstoy looked at them and he said, "Young men, such things very seldom happen. Goodbye." But such are the mighty literary minds. So I, developed this notion that in journalism, long-form journalism, you could actually make a craft out of it. And I have to say that I teach a course on... How am I doing, oh timekeeper? I've already gone over, or... I'm fine. All right, you'll all rue that. I teach a course on the essay in Columbia Writing School, and there are some very good students and some okay students. But I don't know why I didn't see this coming. And I'm not a Luddite at all about the web. But I do think there is some sort of zero-sum game. No, it's not. That's not quite fair. There is some issue with the blog. And the thing about the blog is that it's essentially a staggeringly gorgeous form for utterly unmonitored self-indulgence. It presupposes that anything you might have to say in any order that might occur to you about anything is going to be of interest to some sorry soul out there somewhere, actually. And that all of the kind of wonderful spiny harshness of the essay's form that makes it a glory in humane culture is, for the most part, not true of all blogs. There are blogs, that do think of themselves as crafted in an essayish way, the way described in the Orwell Tolstoy essay. But there are, there's a lot more that have the kind of, raw self-confidence of the entirely formlessly ectoplasmic, really. Just things that just sort of... I mean, the word says it, blog. It's sort of really just out there. Sort of neither solid nor completely liquid, either. So there is a kind of problem. But essays, of course, still are crafted. And then I discovered, actually, that as I tried to write them myself, that there were, as I say, different voices in different genre, all of which are, you know, I mean, slightly different. I mean, I have rather a thing for, you know, at his best, and he wasn't always at his best, depending on how much illicit substances he'd been taken. You know, Hunter Thompson was really just stupendous. Truman Capote, I talked about earlier at our dinner, I think, in his sort of The Music of Chameleons, wonderful, wonderful essayist. We all have our favorites. I love Lester Bangs' rock and roll journalism, thought it had a really extraordinary direct voice. David Foster Wallace, all the kids want to be like David Foster Wallace. You have to be David Foster Wallace, I think, to be like David Foster Wallace, actually. But there are many different... And food writing, which I do a lot of, I have a monthly column now, actually, which are essays with recipes in a British magazine. And food writing is a genre incredible, respectful, because it shares with art writing, actually, a problem of translation, by which I mean that, I was talking about this at the dinner. My hosts were kind enough to let me sit out a bit earlier, that there's some way in which wordiness is incommensurable with looking, that, you know, when you actually take in the complexity and the power of a really great work of art, it's a combination of head and heart, of the immediate visceral impact on your senses of what you're seeing, and then the sort of distribution of that immediate impact into thought processes, memories, pleasure receptors, and so on. And it's very difficult, without embarrassment, to actually find forms of words. I mean, I prefaced my book on Rembrandt's Eyes, where I thought about it a lot, actually, this issue, even though the book is, I know, like a million pages long. So I clearly got over my problem with words a bit in there. I didn't really get over it altogether, but I did preface it by Paul Valéry's famous remark that one should always apologize for talking about painting. And there is an issue of the actual translation. It's weirdly the case with food writing, too, I think. If the food writing really has ambitions to be more simply than you know, what you can buy at the green market and how to cook it, which is a good kind of food writing, actually. But if it has more ambitions and actually to do the things, to do a certain issue with memory, food writing, because of, you know, our olfactory sense being an incredible organ of preserved memory, great food writing really... has, again, this quality of trying to translate sensation, of taste, of texture, of what happens on our palate, into speech or writing. It is the essay I have called Mouthing Off is really about, which I haven't published anywhere else, actually, is about those two things we do with our mouth, speech and taste. And the two don't fit together really without, you know, a particular set of... calculations coming into play. And very often it's some of the most poetic writers, you know, the dangers are of overreach. Most wine writing, there is a writer in England called Andrew Jeffords, who I think genuinely is a kind of almost a poet of wine writing, but most wine writing takes refuge in a kind of fake lexicography, you know, that you have these sort of phrases which are sent to match with certain things, you know, a faint hint of cigar stub or, you know, a memory of wet Burberry or something like that, you know. And then nothing at all to do with what you're just having your Bulgaria Merlot as usual. And you have no idea what they're talking about, Blackberry, you know. You think it's just really annoying, but it's just really a kind of bizarre and completely artificial vocabulary into which they fall. And great food writing really, so that's sort of bad poetry, sort of dull, mechanical, formulaic, fake poetry. But there are some writers who are real poets, prose poets, and the greatest of all, in my view, easily, although I do have a lot of time for Elizabeth David, but the greatest of all is, again, lots of you have read her, I hope, is M.F.K. Fisher. And she's not, and in a way I hate to call her a food writer, because that's why she never became famous, really. And it's like saying, you know, why haven't we heard of this writer, Scott Fitzgerald? You know, someone must have heard of him. She is that good. She's one of the greatest, not just women writers either. She's one of the great 20th century American writers, period. She's a truly extraordinary writer. But she wrote entirely in essay form. And one of the essays I realized, and the recipes are actually not great, as a matter of fact, but they were of a particular period. There's a wonderful book called How to Cook a Wolf, which is actually about surviving the Depression. It's about surviving hard times, the wolf coming in through the door. But the essay I loved, I remember thinking in the way in which I suddenly started to rethink Orwell, was an essay when she, which begins with, "The first thing I cooked was pure poison." And it's something she cooks as a child for her mother, who's just had a baby, of which the young Mary Frances Kennedy Fisher is incredibly jealous. And she decides to make for her mother, and the mother gratifyingly bursts out immediately and terrible, has an allergic reaction in sort of violent welts and blotches. She's made this sort of wobbly, obscenely pallid, extraordinarily kind of milkily, breast-like milk pudding. And to improve it, she said, she ran out and indeed got some blackberries and scattered it round like sort of horrifying aureola around the middle of the kind of breast pudding, really. It's very funny and it's very knowing and it's extraordinary. And that's what M.F.K. Fisher, she writes about life and desire and disappointment and tragedy. And I'll just finish with, and it's nice to read you. I hope you will read my stuff as well. Well, I'll read you, can I finish my two short readings? Here's me with sort of Mary Frances K. Fisher. I wish she was one of the few writers I really wish I'd known. She died in, she was a real tartar apparently as an old lady, but I would love to have been on the whip end of her tongue. She lived in Napa Valley. She died, I think, in the 90s, and she was in her 80s. Here's me trying, with her very much in mind, but not trying to be like her, but trying to find the kind of child's voice. This is the beginning of my essay on ice cream, which is one of the nicer pieces in the book, I hope. And I'll read you a little bit from that, because it is about milk. And then I'll read you a little bit from one of her, which I have in one of my own essays at the end, which is an amazing one. Here's the ice cream bit. Summer 1956, Anthony Eden, then Prime Minister, is dreaming dangerous Egyptian dreams, which in the following autumn will send what little remains of the British Empire right up the creek, aka the Suez Canal. But we don't know about that, and if we did, we wouldn't care. It's the last day of school. We've seen off the 11+, that's an elementary school exam. And out there in pebbled-ash London, beyond the gritty little playground of our primary school, beyond the black spiked railings hung with tendrils of bindweed, there's a siren chiming. Bing, bong, bingety, bongety, bong. Mr. Whippy is calling. And we, short-trousered, snake-belted, grimy-kneed, snot-nosed, want what he's got. We want a 99. That's a particularly toxic kind of ice cream. God, how we want it, that shaggy bark chocolate stick plunged into a mound of air-pumped chalky glop, which would be called vanilla were it not to defame the dark bean. But then we weren't too organic, not in 1956. So we charge out through the rusting green gates and break into our version of La Donna Immobile. My name's Antonio. I sell ice creamio down your back alley-o, tuppence a lickio. The delirium of ice cream is inseparable from juvenile glee, the uninhibited indulgence of the mouth. To get your tongue round a dollop is to become instantaneously childlike again, whatever your age, to cop a mouthful of lusciousness that magically marries opposites, fruit and dairy, tart and voluptuous. A shot of excitement meets a scoop of all's well. Yes, yes, doctor, we know the taking of the cone heap mound in our greedy gobs makes us blissed out babies again, tripping down mammary lane, slurp, lick, suck, even on occasions drool and slobber. But it is more complicated than milky regression. And here's M.F.K. Fisher, young MFK Fisher with her first husband, Al Fisher, who's been assigned to a teaching job just before the war in Strasbourg. And she's alone and a bit forlorn and a bit grumpy about being there. And here's what she does about it. In the morning, in a soft, sultry chamber, it's in a slightly kind of sweaty, over-radiated room. Sit in the window peeling tangerines, three or four. Peel them gently. Do not bruise them as you watch soldiers past and pass the corner and over the canal towards the watched Rhine. German song about the Rhine. Separate each plump little pregnant crescent. If you find the kiss, the secret section, save it for Al, her husband. Listen to the chambermaid thumping up the pillows and murmur encouragement to her thick Alsatian tales of l'intérieur, while she mutters of seduction and bicyclists who ride more than wheels, tear delicately from the soft pile of sections each velvet string. You know those white pulpy strings that hold tangerines into their skins? Tear them off. Be careful. The sections of tangerines are gone, and I cannot tell you why they are so magical. Perhaps it is that little shell, thin as one layer of enamel on a Chinese bowl, that crackles so tinnily, so ultimately, under your teeth. Or perhaps it is the rush of cold pulp just after it, or the perfume. I cannot tell. There must be someone, though, who knows what I mean. Probably everyone does, because of his own secret eatings. They don't do that kind of thing in blogs. Thank you. Thanks.
So the way this works is if you raise your hand, we'll get a microphone to you. And I think given the breadth of topics in Scribble Scribble, I think we can ask about anything from art to ice cream to the Royals. So
I don't do automotive repair, actually. I never will. Sorry, actually. We were talking about cars, but I don't wouldn't know carburetor if it hit me.
All right, no car discussions. And all the way in back, Michelle with her hand up about...
Hi. I'd like to know, sort of with respect to the royal wedding coming up at the end of the week, what your thoughts are on the role and the relevance of the monarchy in the 21st century?
The role of the monarchy, and you said the relevance.
The role and the relevance in the 21st century.
Well, it's a sort of, you know, relatively innocuous false god to which we genuflect to take our minds off issues of power, which isn't to say that the monarchy isn't powerful in the sense in which it, you know, consumes money, really, in particular. But the reason why, I thought, did you read the piece in the New York Times yesterday called The Tarnished Crown? That was one of the worst pieces from a really great journalist, actually. It was nonsensical. It used very, very revealingly, the writer, who definitely will be nameless, used the word many, as in many Britons feel that, you know, the monarchy, because of the collapse of Charles and Diana's marriage and, you know, the various kind of mishaps that have befallen it, or, you know, crimes and misdemeanors, that it's worthless and ought to be gone. But actually, it is true that some people, some would have been a more accurate word. I mean, the opinion polls, whatever one feels about it, are really unequivocal. It's about 75% of Britons, not just the English, really want to see it stay. And then there are some, there'll probably be a lot more people than the mere 20% or something who are actively hostile to the monarchy, who'll be just not interested on Friday. But what it does is a certain kind of, you know, it's an anthropological event, essentially, an event in cultural anthropology, which doesn't make it worthless. The royal family is essentially a kind of emblem, really, which tries to do two things at once. It's not, and again, the writer quoted Walter Badger, but Walter Badger is no longer really a reliable source to think about the monarchy, because it all the Walter Badger presupposed that the monarchy was effective insofar as it was distant. But actually, a large part of Queen Victoria's appeal was that she created a bourgeois family, to be sure, a bourgeois family that would sort of went wrong in the shape of her older son, the Prince of Wales and Edward the Seventh, but it was kind of bourgeois family idol. As we say here, and that's sort of both been the strength and also the problem for royal family. If you're going to have a kind of, you know, they're just like us, but in some deep, peculiar, strange way, they're incredibly not like us. Then it's sort of tricky act to do, and you know, we'll see how well the beneficiaries of the nuptials do. There's more and more writing to notice that Kate Middleton, you know, Catherine, really has never really held down a job, much less than Diana, actually, who did have a, you know, steady job in her nursery and kindergarten. But Kate Middleton has not really done very much like that. And so, you know, it's essentially, you can say if you're, you know, a Marxist, or I suppose a Republican, that the monarchy exists to enslave Britons in a state of false consciousness. That may not be entirely wrong, but it's a sort of, you know, a voluntary submission, really, to this state, I think. And I think sort of, especially in hard times, really, the Britons, for better or worse, are apt to really want something which represents a relatively uncontroversial, power-free zone of kind of emblematic charisma. I was lucky enough to get, as it my fellow countrymen call it, you know, a gong, a sort of, a thing, which made me absurdly a commander of the British Empire. I don't really have a lot to command. This brought me into very close contact with the Queen. I mean, really close, you know, almost kind of clinch close, because you have to bend your head as she puts the gong around you. And then you raise it to this sort of, and you're confused for a moment, because what you're seeing is the kind of strange emblematic waxworks, which appears animatronically to be saying things to you, you know. And I just finished, this is why I got the gong for the History of Britain series, and the animatronic thing said, "I gather you have a video." And we've been told, and I said, "Yes, ma'am," you know. And then there was a long pause, you know. I said, "It's about the History of Britain." I said, "Yes, I gather." And then a sort of dim light bulb went on. I said, "Would you have seen it?" "Not yet." And I realized I was being panhandled in Buckingham Palace. And I said, "Shall I send one round? That would be nice." So I did. I thought, you know, God, bloody royals, you know, yeah.
I didn't know John Cleese was the Queen of England. About, yeah, a little further back.
My question may be an oxymoron. But as an American, do you have a favorite American author, either living or dead, and could you give the reason?
Wow. Why is that an oxymoron? I mean, favorite American? Wow. There are just so, you know, again, I'm going to do the weedy thing. There are different reasons to be passionate about different writers. I am a big Mel Villian, I have to say. I was talking about him at dinner, both in gargantuan Moby Dick form and also especially, really, in Bartleby, Benito Sereno kind of form, really. It's the sheer kind of mad, vertiginous, throw yourself out of a window and see how the sentence lands style, actually, of Melville attempts, and was a catastrophic failure, of course, actually, in terms of the public eye, that I find really extraordinary. I mean, I think he does really change the language a bit in that way. We were just talking about prose, aren't we? We're talking about poetry as well. Really weirdly, because he's so damn flinty, I do have a sort of deep feeling for Robert Lowell, actually. I mean, he was very historically rich, and, you know, it seems to go against everything I'd said about, as it were, me being sort of Dickens-light, you know, Dickensian in temper, but I do rather love Robert Lowell's And I do like Robert Frost as well, very, very much. I was very glad to see Brodsky wrote an amazing, if you want to read the best thing almost ever written about Robert Frost, that he's not just a nature poet, but a poet really very brooding on issues of life and death and everything in between. There's a great essay, which you can just get from the New Yorker online archive, that Brodsky wrote not very long before he died himself, about Robert Frost. I did love, but I knew him quite well. We became friends. I did love Joseph Heller very much. Maybe he's a one book, although I think there's at least one other book of Heller's, which is wonderful. But I thought Catch 22 was an extraordinary kind of burlesque black masterpiece. And I'll tell you something else. And I think, you know, why I'm slightly hesitant about, because I think of books rather than, you know, complete frame. You know, I'm not indifferent to Fitzgerald at all. I loved Fitzgerald deeply, actually. Not just Fitzgerald of Gatsby, but Fitzgerald of Tender as the Night, too, which is, you know, hopeless mess in some ways and just staggering masterpiece in others, I think. But particular books, a book I was really stunned to realize how extraordinary it was is The Naked and the Dead. Maynard wrote it when it was 22, I think. It was just absolutely extraordinary. And I'm not sure, including, you know, Heller, I'm not sure anything as great will ever be written, certainly about American War, ever again. And now, in a sense, the form of the book seems a cliche because it's sort of a buddy book, essentially, backstories behind each member of a particularly chronic platoon. But it has this kind of epic, extraordinary kind of epic, tragic, Greek tragic quality to it. And just simply, I think, the sharpness, the kind of visualization of the young Mailer is amazing. And it's sort of been forgotten, I think, really, because of the cumbrousness of late Mailer's books, I think. That's a sampling, I guess. I do love Faulkner. I hope it's not a brush off, but this is a subject which sort of came up at supper. And what I said was that we were given a lot of American writing to read in England in the 1950s, which is a wonderful thing. And we were given, I'm always grateful for that, we were given what you would think of as the kind of least accessible, not because they were difficult books, but the books that sounded least like Charlotte Bronte and Jane Austen and Anthony Trollope and indeed Dickens. And you know, when you read The Scarlet Letter, it was, you thought, what is this? Or, you know, you read Bartleby, you thought, what is this? Read Salinger, actually, of course, again, they all read Catcher in the Rye, but we were sort of given everything, really, Franny and Zoe, and, you know, and that also was, it was the sort of pungent incommensurability of wrought American prose, magnificently wrought American prose, with its kind of weird, sort of apostrophic, exalted voice. You know, Whitman, I loved Whitman, really, for its madness. You know, we used to go round, really, you know. I sing at the body electric, bloody well do, we'd say to each other, or words to that effect, and beating our chests in the Whitman way. I loved all that, and I still do like sort of extreme American writing, I would say. I love extreme, raw, uncompromising. There is a writer who's really been forgotten, if any of you have heard of him, but once you hear the name, you won't forget it, but he is very, very dark and murderous, and indeed shot himself after one volume of short stories, which I think was genuinely tragic. He was clearly slightly unhinged. His name is Brees DJ Pancake. That was his real name. And he lived, as you might expect, in the Appalachians. And have any of you actually read him or heard of him? No, he may even be out of print, but he is really a remarkable, remarkable American writer of particularly terrible, tragic demeanor. Another, they all seem to kill themselves. John Kennedy Toole, I think, A Confederacy of Dunces is, again, one of the great, out-of-control, extreme American comic novels. The book he wrote called The Neon Bible when he was just 18, again, almost as remarkable. So I like extreme American writing.
Shall we continue? Lady in the fourth row with her hand.
I read anything that you or Tony Judt used to write. And in terms of Tony Judt, he stayed in one area of politics. Now, are you, is this Trump?
Of politics, you're saying? Well, I mean, he had one set of views.
Political discourse, basically.
Yeah.
And you have peaks and troughs. And is it because you hone your writing skills and keep them sharp by going from, you know, the extremes of writing? I mean,
different styles, yeah.
Yes. I'm just curious.
You know, I get interested in things, and the things I'm interested in lead me to be interested in something else, and that leads me to be. I sort of run around in that way, I suppose. I don't think I do it. And it is a test. It is a test, you know, because you do. Do you think of readership when you write for the Financial Times or you write for the New Yorker? Or I don't think I really try and classify a demographic or something about that. But the remarks I was making, I hope not entirely facetiously, about the untranslatability of food experience of taste into prose or of painting. And I do actually write about pop music a bit. And there would have been some of those pieces in here, but the buddy music publishers charge outrageous sums in order to be able to quote lyrics, and they're not. But that's the same sort of issue as well. I think it's sort of a sense of life is short. You want to try your hand, actually, at different idioms. I suppose it's the way an actor might not want to be, you know, stuck with a comic or a tragic role or something, that you really want to kind of push the language, really, in different directions rather than have a single consistent voice. It may make you a flippity, but, you know, it may make you, in the end, I don't know, compromise. I do have, if you want to look at, you know, there is a particular voice where I'm trying to present as clearly and as accessibly as possible a quite complicated argument. There are at least two pieces in which were lectures, which I have worked on to be slightly less lecture-like. One, both on Victorians, one on Ruskin and one on Thomas Carlyle. And they have a particular voice, which I think is, I hope, just not a kind of standard conventional academic voice, but certainly the voice is one designed for bundling together a set of analytical arguments on top of a kind of narrative about those who are making them, I think. I will say about Tony, it's very interesting you mentioned Tony Judt. Tony and I knew each other for a long time. We were students together at Cambridge in the 60s, and we had lots of differences, political and other, and methodological. But they were always kind of very above board differences. We did have sort of quite, I mean, not fierce arguments, but some differences. And I think we admired each other. I certainly admired him, and I thought the book called Postwar is sort of a masterpiece, really, about Europe since the war. But if any of you, again, I guess you have read The Memory Chalet, have you? Oh, you haven't? Wow, you've got a treat. The Memory Chalet is a sort of collection of pieces he wrote as he was dying. He died of Lou Gehrig's disease, one of the most terrible ways you can die, because just last year, I think, last August, yeah. And because, you know, your brain never goes, it's the last thing to go practically. So you observe your increasing incapacity day by day, hour by hour, minute by minute. And he was the bravest, most uncomplaining. And he wrote this, he was writing these essays about memory as he was dying. And it's a very short book. And it's arguably the greatest thing he did, actually. And I'm rather distressed it doesn't matter. I mean, he's dead. But I wish I could have told him how extraordinary the little book is. It's about his childhood. It's about growing up. It's about sort of everything, really, in the space of about 150 pages. It's called The Memory Chalet. And it's a deeply, deeply, deeply moving book, a book of real hard-edged, unsentimental intelligence. And those of you who don't know who we're talking about, the name is J-U-D-T, J-U-D-T, Tony Judt. And read it. It'll change your life. It really will, I think, actually.
Yeah, if you want to hear him speak, we have a podcast on our website
good.
One more question. Gentleman in the white, about six rows into the middle there. On your right, Marla.
Yeah. Thank you. Please share your thoughts on putting together the power of art, both the book and the outstanding videos, and how that they complement each other and how that thought process worked.
Oh, thank you very much. That's very kind. Those of you who don't know, Power of Art was a television series. It was conceived of always as a television series, but I knew, as I do with the books that are, I hate the words, little companion books, I never wanted simply to deposit scripts for each film and then make that the book. So the book chapters are inevitably a much more elaborate. There's only so much you can do in an hour of television, long period there that is. I tell you why that book happened, actually, and thank you for asking it. There are some art historians and among you here tonight, and you will know very well that so-called contextualism is really de rigueur for. That's to say that for a while, anyway, it was sort of almost militant contextualism, by which, as a result of literary theory, let's not, it's late already, we don't need to talk about that very much. The notion was that there are these great men in a kind of gallery. There are the Leonardos and the Rembrandts and the Picassos and the Cezannes and so on. It was kind of a romantic myth, and the notion of the great artist brooding and solitary, melancholy, was something dreamed up by the Romantics. Actually, as a matter of historical fact, it wasn't dreamed up by the Romantics. It was dreamed up by the likes of Giorgio Vasari in the 16th century, who describes Michelangelo precisely in those terms. And it was a commonplace of writing about artists, both in Italy and the Netherlands, to talk about the fact that some of their melancholy disposition, which was part of their creative instinct, came from an excess of black bile, something we all feel we have sometimes on a bad Monday morning when it's raining yet again. So in fact, it wasn't, but there was a tremendous fashion to say enough already that really art is a kind of, it's a sort of deposit of a relationship. And I think this is true between a patron, an artist, and the way the artist perceives the competition he has before him. And the competition he really wants to beat in some way, which artists are very susceptible to. So enough of that. That's the sort of thing which I felt had been gone too far in a way. That it was actually historically, objectively, a falsification, actually, of the way artists conceived of their own activity at not all the time, but at some moments of crisis. And it's not that it's only a romantic, melodramatic writing about artists that invent crises for artists to have. They really do have them. You know, there was almost no great artist to think of who didn't actually have an incredibly difficult moment with a particular composition, whatever it was. There may be some artists, Renoir, possibly, you know, who live their life in a moment of imperturbable serenity from beginning to end, but there are not many of those. You look at the early Cézanne, for example, it's full of horrifyingly agonized moments of violence and cruelty and all sorts of weird things before you get to the much more Irenic Cézanne. So I thought I wanted to really reinstate the notion of a kind of heroic narrative of the artist, you know, woo, the utter no-no to do that. As I did with Rembrandt's Eyes, I did feel the documentation inside Rembrandt's life and everything one knows about him from those around him made it quite clear that Rembrandt was far more than someone who simply responded to the Dutch society of his time. We know that he's a real mold breaker. So the idea for the series was take one work of art, almost forensically, Caravaggio's portrait of himself as the decapitated Goliath, an extraordinary thing to do, especially if you're a convicted murderer on the run. The painting that Rembrandt did for the Amsterdam Town Hall, which was rejected and which he had to literally scissor up himself in an attempt to sell it as a smaller work of art to someone who would buy it, an attempt that was not successful. Picasso, who made a huge fetish of never being a political artist, deciding at this particular point in his life in 1937 to do Guernica, and so on. So I thought you could make a kind of drama of creativity on television around backtracking forensically from that one moment of critical difficulty for an artist without being, you know. And so everything we did, everything that was said by the actors, we didn't have actors in all of them, but many of them, were absolutely rock solid documents, with one exception. And the director, normally it was only because I was actually busy in the cutting room cutting a different film that I missed the fact that this naughty director in the first film of Caravaggio, that, you know, there's no need to make anything up about Caravaggio. He's, as you all know. So you don't need him. We know he dies, you know, he stumbles and collapses on the beach of Porto Ercole and may have died there, may not, may have been in the hospital of the monks. There's no need suddenly to have Caravaggio, you know, move on the sand and go, no! No, they've run out of milk or something. You know. I mean, that's so annoying, because it seemed to me to absolutely belie all the very careful credentials we'd set ourselves. But the response to the series, and it goes on being shown by schools, and has been really wonderful. We won an Emmy for it. And technically, I think I'll probably, in terms of lighting and photographing, I'll probably never make a better film than the Bernini film, which is what we won the Emmy for. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.